So this is the first of three talks that we're going to have on Wednesday nights. And the overall topic, actually, as it's said, I don't know where it is on some of the materials, is the inner workings of the human heart, which sounds overly ambitious to talk about the inner workings of the human heart, and probably is. There is a lot that I would like to say about the inner workings of the human heart that I'm not going to say, because the three talks are really focused on identity and then joy and then
purpose.
Thank you. I was going to say agenda, but purpose. Yeah, purpose. Identity, joy, and purpose. And so if you have questions more about sort of the heart, I would love to talk about those afterwards. I could probably talk your ear off about those afterwards. But in these three talks, we're focusing on identity, joy, and purpose, each one. So we're going to start talking about identity. And college can be a great time of kind of self-discovery. And when I got to college, though, I was so clueless, I didn't even realize there was such a thing as self-discovery or self-knowledge, which is really all the more amazing because my life up to that point was so consumed with my own identity, but I just didn't know it. When I was a kid, I never felt like I fit in. We moved midway through kindergarten, and from then on, I consciously felt like an outsider. Now, it was kindergarten, right? But I remember in kindergarten that there was the in crowd, you know, the kindergarten in crowd. And there were these two kids that, in my mind, made up that in crowd. And both of their names were Scott. It was Scott and Scott. And I still remember that. And I don't remember much from kindergarten. But there was Scott and Scott. And one of the kids' names, I'm not making this up, was Scott Slick. Right? Scott Slick. And so there were Scott and Scott were the really cool kids in kindergarten. They were the in crowd in my mind, or at least part of it. And I was friends with one of the Scots. Can't remember which one. Maybe Scott Slick. I don't know. I was friends with one of the Scots, but I was never a part of the in crowd, even in kindergarten, right? And I was 5 years old in kindergarten. That was 32 years ago. But nevertheless, I still remember that desire to be accepted, right, to be in kindergarten. And my parents got divorced when I was 9, which only made that feeling of being on the outside even greater. It made this desire to be in even greater, to belong somewhere even greater. And so I spent the remainder of my childhood trying to get on the inside of whatever group I was around. C.S. Lewis talks about this in his essay, The Inner Ring. And he talks about the fact that most of us live with this sense of inside and outside, right? There's this group, and they're in, and I'm not in that group, right? We know that we're on the outside, and we want to be on the inside. We try to be on the inside, but we know that we're not there. And he even says, as soon as you get into a group, that group becomes boring to you, and you want to get into an even further inner ring. And so there's this, like, like a tree stump. There's ring after ring after ring, right? You're trying to get to the center to be in. And when you come to college for the first time, it brings up all of those feelings. It did for me way back when, in a year, a long time ago. I won't tell you when it was. But I wanted to belong, to fit in. And sometimes it doesn't even matter what the group is that you belong to. You just want to be in some group somewhere, right? You just want to belong to somebody. And it might be a fraternity. It might be a sorority. It might be a group of three kids that all like the same music, the same books, dress in the same clothes, right? It doesn't matter as long as you know where you belong, where you fit. You could take this in a really negative way, right? I mean, you could think as if there's something wrong with finding your identity in a group, finding your acceptance in a group. But of course, historically, that negative view hasn't been the case, right? Even today, in traditional parts of the world, your identity is based on the group. It's based on your family. It's based on your clan, your tribe, your city, your country, your race, your role in society, right? Your identity is found in traditional parts of the world. It's found in this larger group, right? In your relationships, in this complex of relationships to people around you. We kind of poo-poo that in America because we live in this age of sort of the self-made man or the self-made woman, right? We encourage people to be their own person. And for many of us, the thought, for example, that a child might go into the family business is kind of quaint, right? It's kind of a leftover thought from yesteryear that somebody might follow in their father's footsteps. We want people to find their own identity. We encourage people to blaze their own trail wherever that might lead them. And by that, we must mean something like find an identity not based on familial or communal relationships, right? You find your own identity. Go be your own person. Those are the kinds of things we say. Of course, it seems to me that when you stop looking to your family or to your society or to your clan or whoever, right, to dictate your role or your identity, we tend to simply look to other people. So we look to maybe a school teacher that we really respect, or you look to a classmate, or you look to a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Instead of looking for acceptance from your family, in being a part of that family, we look for acceptance elsewhere. Very few people, if any, are really just trying to live for their own self-acceptance, right? We're looking to be accepted by someone, somewhere. And interestingly, all of these different ways of finding identity, whether from your family in a traditional culture or from the people around you or even from yourself, all of those can be equally oppressive. So if I'm trying to live for my family and I don't live up to my family standards, then I face rejection. And so there is this internal drive based on fear to live up, right? To achieve, to fit in. If I'm trying to please or fit in with my teachers or my classmates, then if I don't live up to my teacher's standards or my classmate standards or my boyfriend's standards, right, then I face rejection. And so again, there's this internal drive based on fear to achieve, to find an identity, to be accepted by these people based on what we do. It's true even with ourselves, right? If I don't live up to my own standards, if I don't become the person I want to be, if I don't have the success I want to have, if I don't accomplish the things that I want to do, then I face what may be the worst rejection of all of those, right? Which is sort of a self-rejection, a self-hatred. So there's, again, this internal drive based on fear to succeed. When Tim Keller, a pastor in New York, talks about these kinds of things, he always mentions two specific people. And you can go, like, read through his sermons, listen to his sermons, read through his books, and he's always mentioning these two people. And one is Harold Abrahams, who won the gold medal in the 1924 Olympics for the 100-meter dash. And Abrahams is in the movie Chariots of Fire, which was a movie made in the 80s. So it's been a while. For some of you, to me, that's like, oh, it was just made a couple years ago. And Abraham, in this movie, he says, when asked why he wanted to win the 100-meter dash, he answered, "When that gun goes off, I have 10 seconds to justify my existence." Right? So he's racing, and Keller comments, he essentially said, if I can win this race, if I can be an accomplished athlete, I can face the world, and then I know that I matter. Right? I've got 10 seconds to justify my existence. That's why he was racing. That's why he wanted to win, because he wanted to prove himself. The other person Keller always mentions whenever he talks about this is Madonna. Right? And he quotes an interview with Madonna from Vanity Fair, and Madonna says this. She says, "I have an iron will. And all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I'm always struggling with that fear," says Madonna. "I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, and then I get to another stage and think I'm mediocre and uninteresting. And I find a way to get myself out of that. Again and again, my drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me, because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. And so do you see what both Madonna and Abrahams are saying, right? They're both trying to prove themselves. Maybe not in the traditional way, right? They're not trying to find their identity in the traditional roles of society, of a traditional society, but they're both driven by this fear of being nobodies and wanting to be somebody and wanting to prove to the world that they are somebody. Now, I don't necessarily think traditional societies are better than our modern society in this respect, but I do think my guess would be that we struggle with this even more than people in traditional societies in one sense, because they at least they knew their identity, they knew their role, whereas we constantly have to invent our own role. We constantly have to answer the question, who am I? Whereas in a traditional society, at least for the most part, you know who you are, you know where you stand. You may fail at that or you may succeed at that, but at least you know. We don't even know what we're supposed to succeed at, right? I have to be somebody, but I don't even know who that somebody is. See, this drive is something really basic to humanity. This desire to prove yourself, this desire to be accepted, this desire to belong and to be loved. It's a desire to be someone, to make an identity for yourself, to establish yourself in some way. My sister was baptized recently, actually very recently, just a few weeks ago. And she said in her testimony beforehand, which I got to watch on Facebook because that's how you watch these things nowadays, apparently. And she said that because she was adopted, she never felt like she belonged anywhere. Now, what's interesting is when I was a kid, I felt the same way, though I wasn't adopted, right? And I think that's because many of us feel that at some point. We feel like we don't fit because we're kind of trapped in here in our own heads, right? And we just feel like, yeah, I don't really belong. I know what's going on in my head, and you don't know what's going on in my head, and there's a disconnect somewhere along the line. There's something intrinsic to being human that longs for belonging, that longs for affirmation and shrinks from rejection. And especially when we have been rejected, we seek to prove ourselves, like Madonna or like Abraham's, right? Because our identity is wrapped up in whether I belong, whether I'm accepted, whether I'm affirmed, or whether I've been rejected. And I would even go so far as to say that acceptance and affirmation and belonging are actually basic human needs. How can we explain that, right? Or why can I say that? Of course, since I'm a pastor, I understand life by looking at what the Bible teaches. So what I want to do with the rest of our time is to look at three things that the Bible teaches that impact our identity. The Bible's teaching on creation, the Bible's teaching on sin, and the Bible's teaching on redemption. Now, when I talk about the Bible's teaching on creation, what I don't mean is whether the world was created 6,000 years or 6 billion years ago. In fact, what I'm about to say isn't affected by that debate at all. The Bible teaches that humanity was created in God's image, created to be like God. Now, whatever else that means, and it's profound, whatever else it means that we were created with a certain dignity. We were created to be like God. After God created humanity, one of the first things that he did was to give us his approbation, his approval, his acceptance, his affirmation, right? God looked at all that he had made after he created man, and he said, it is very good, which included humanity, right? God is making his statement about humanity is, it is very good. What that meant was that humanity, along with the rest of creation, fulfilled the purpose for which God created us. God said, I approve of you and affirm that you are doing the thing for which you were created. Now, have you ever been in a room full of people, a large gathering, maybe for a lecture much bigger than this, right? And you're at this big gathering and you suddenly realize that you know the person who's speaking. And not only do you know the person who's speaking, but the speaker actually comes up to you and acknowledges you by name, right? The speaker recognizes you. And there's this feeling that you get when that happens, right? At first, when you realize, hey, I know this guy, there's like this feeling inside of you. And then if he actually calls you out and says, you know, hey, Ben, how's it going? Good to see you there, right? Suddenly, there's this feeling inside of you. And it's not quite pride, but it's a feeling of joy, right, that you've been remembered, that you've been known, that you've been acknowledged. You were made for that feeling. Right, this should be a key part of our identity, that we were created in the divine image, that I was created to be like my Creator. This is who I am. This is who God made me to be, His creature in His image. And I was created to have His approval, His acceptance, His approbation. You were created to find your identity then in the approval of another. Right? We were created to find our identity in the approval of someone else, in the approval of our Creator. Now, of course, sadly, the story of the Bible doesn't end there. It goes on, which brings us to the Bible's teaching on sin. And just two chapters after creation, humanity begins rebelling against our Creator. 1,500 or so words into the Bible, Adam and Eve begin to depart the script. They begin to write their own story. Now, again, in our culture, we almost see this as a good thing, right? In modern America, it seems like the beginning of a coming-of-age movie, right, where the teen rejects their narrow-minded parents and heads off, right, in search of meaning in the big city somewhere, right? They leave their family, they leave their town, and now they're off to make themselves, to make a name for themselves, to establish themselves. But of course, as you read in the rest of the Bible, that's not what happens. Humanity doesn't go off, and it's not this great story of humanity establishing a name for ourselves, although we try. But humanity actually makes a mess out of the world, right? Violence takes over, especially in the fourth chapter of Genesis, right? Murder, the first murder happens, violence takes over. And it only gets worse as you read on, and humanity has become sinful, right? That's what we're seeing, is sin has entered the world. Sin has corrupted our hearts. And as important as creation in God's image is to our identity, human sinfulness is actually just as important. Now, that may seem really odd, but human sinfulness is important. And even if you've been following me up to this point, you might think that I just stepped off the crazy cliff, right? Like, human sinfulness, how could that be important for my own self-identity? You might even think, wouldn't it be psychologically unhealthy to think of yourself as a sinner? And actually, I would say not only is it not unhealthy, but it's actually healthy if you acknowledge your own sinfulness. And I'm going to give reasons why that's true. I'm going to give three reasons, actually, why sin is an important part of your identity, an important piece of your own self-knowledge. If you don't see yourself as sinful, then you have to do something with moral failure, right? You have to do something with the times when you yourself fall short. And you're going to probably do one of two things. You might deny it. You might say, well, no, I never fail morally. I always live up to my own standards. I always do the right thing. I'm an upstanding person. Everything I do is always above board. Which means that you have to deny, at the very least, you have, even if you are as upright a person as anyone has met, you have to deny those thoughts that you have that no one else knows about. Those thoughts that you have that you know are wrong. You have to pretend that you don't think those thoughts. You have to lie, right? You have to lie to yourself. You have to tell yourself that there's nothing wrong with me. I'm perfectly fine. Nothing bad here. So if you refuse to see yourself as sinful, you have to lie to yourself about what's going on inside your heart and mind. Or if you're not going to lie to yourself about your moral failures, you say, well, they're not really moral failures. It's perfectly natural for me to have these kinds of thoughts. It's perfectly okay for me to think these things. Of course, the problem with that is where that goes. If all of these thoughts, if all of the impulses in my heart, if all of the desires are perfectly natural, then it should be perfectly natural for me to indulge them as well. If there's nothing morally wrong to think about killing someone, for example, right? Then how can it be morally wrong for me to actually act on that thought? Think about it this way. To say that there is nothing wrong with me, all my thoughts, all my impulses, all my desires are right, or at the worst, morally neutral, then that means that the actions that flow from those thoughts are at worst morally neutral. Which means that really we can just justify anything and everything, right? Murder and theft and rape and oppression and prejudice and racism, right? If there's nothing wrong with people, then there's nothing wrong with the actions of people. See, we need a doctrine of sin in order to, on the one hand, be honest with ourselves, right? I'm sinful. I know what's going on inside my head. I know it shouldn't be there. And we need not only to be honest with ourselves, but also to not justify everything that goes on in my heart and mind, to say that actually this is not good, and what it leads to often is not good. I am sinful. There is something wrong with me. But third, we also need a doctrine of sin, because if I'm not broken, I can't be fixed. You know, if something's not broken, you can't fix it. This is the classic AA, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. If you've ever sat in on an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, which I'm not endorsing all of AA or every part of AA, but a key part of it is admitting that you have a problem, right? People in Alcoholics Anonymous know that if you don't first admit that you are an alcoholic, you can't overcome your alcoholism. And so if you don't admit you have a problem, you're never going to change. Where did AA get this? Well, they got it from the church, right? AA got this from the Bible. They got it from the church, because it's only when we confess that we are sinful and we know it that we can begin to combat sin. Only when we acknowledge that we are broken does God begin to put us back together. See, acknowledging sinfulness then is incredibly hopeful, because if I know that I'm broken, if I know something's wrong with me, then there's hope that I can be made right. If this is just the way that I'm supposed to be, if this is just natural and normal and morally neutral, then this is the way I am, and nothing's ever going to change. There's no hope of being different. So seeing yourself as sinful, as a part of your identity, as a part of your core even, is not only not unhealthy, but I would say it's actually incredibly healthy, because it's a way of being honest with yourself. It's a way of not justifying every thought and impulse that goes through your brain, and it's a way that's very hopeful. Because if I'm broken, maybe I can be fixed. Maybe I can be put back together. So if you take the doctrine of sin away, right, then you have to lie to yourself, or you have to justify everything that goes through your mind and say it's good or okay or right or at least neutral. And you have to do that without any real hope of change. But to accept that brings a problem. To accept human sinfulness, to accept my sinfulness, brings a problem, right? To be sinful in the scriptures means I no longer have God's approval. And so the very thing, or one of the very things I was created for, is now lost. We said a moment ago that we were made for God's approbation, God's acceptance. The very first thing God does after humanity falls into sin is send them out of the garden, out of his presence, out of fellowship with himself. And to me, this explains why we are so crazed with proving ourselves all the time. We lack the acceptance of the one person who truly matters. And so we spend our lives like Harold Abrahams or like Madonna, trying to justify our existence, trying to prove that we are somebody, to show that we are worth it, to be accepted. And it's interesting, as you watch people or watch your own heart and see the ways that you try to prove yourself to people around you, we normally don't do this morally. We try to prove ourselves by every other strength, every attribute, every talent, whether beauty or knowledge or athletic ability or even drinking prowess, right? We invent categories just so we can excel in them. Right, I'm going to make something up. And look, I'm the best person at this. I mean, just read the Guinness Book of World Records, right? All of the absurd things that are in there that people excel at. We try to prove ourselves in every way, often except the one in which we all fail so miserably, which is morally. Now, it's not always true, right? Sometimes people try to think of themselves as better than others morally as well. But most of us, we stay away from that category, maybe particularly in our day, because we know that we don't have a shot of even placing right morally. We know that if there's a, you know, a first place, second place, third place, a gold, you know, ribbon, a silver, whatever, I'm not going to be on that list. And so we find something else, some other strength that I have, so I can prove myself that I'm really good at, you know, fill in the blank. Most of us stay away from moral. Having lost God's approbation, we are driven by the approval of others, family and friends, professors and peers, even ourselves, in the hopes of receiving even the smallest amount of praise from someone that we think matters. Now, if that's where we were left, that would be a pretty miserable place to be, because now we're in a place where I long for this approbation, this praise, this approval, yet I don't have it because of sin, and so I'm left trying to chase this from everybody else, trying to get your acceptance, trying to get you to like me, trying to get you to love me in the hopes of feeling this again, right? Feeling the praise, feeling the approval of another human being or another person. But of course, it gets better in the Bible. To have a right identity, we do need to have a consciousness of being created in the divine image, of that image being broken and in need of repair. But finally, the New Testament tells us about God's method of repair in Jesus. And that brings us to the Bible's teaching on redemption. And there are a couple things, there are five things actually, but I'll go fast in them. There are five things that the New Testament tells us about God's acceptance of us in Jesus. It tells us that we're loved, that we're forgiven, that we're accepted, that we're justified and delighted in. I'm going to go through each of those briefly. You know, the classic verse in the New Testament is John 3:16, right? John 3:16, which says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life." And I want you to focus on just the beginning part of that verse for a moment. "For God so loved the world." What's so amazing about that verse? What's amazing about that verse is it is proclaiming God's love for sinful humanity. For God so loved this sinful, broken, fallen mess that he gave his only son. If God loves sinful humanity that much, right, then there may be hope for you and me, right? For God so loved the world. And certainly there are different degrees of love, right? I mean, but some degree of love is at the bottom of all acceptance, all approbation, all approval. And so even in this one verse, we have the glimmer, at least, of regaining the acceptance that we once had, that God can love sinful people, right? Well, how is that possible? Well, that brings us to the next thing, which is forgiveness. Jesus tells us that he came with authority to forgive sins. The problem with having sinfulness as a part of your identity is that it acts like this great permanent blot on your record. You're constantly trying to overcome it, to make something of yourself, to do penance, right? To prove yourself, to make up. But in the end, you know you failed, right? This is what lies behind Madonna's quote earlier, right? She says, if you remember, she said, "All of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I've always struggled with that fear. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, and then I get to another stage and I think I'm mediocre and uninteresting." What's going on, right? No matter what we do, something always tells us it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. We're still missing something. And that's because whatever we do, whatever great feat we accomplish, we still know deep down that we have this moral failure in our souls, that there's something wrong with us before God. That all the talent, all the strength, all the beauty, all the knowledge in the world can't hide that. Whoever we impress, we still know that deep down that we stand before a God who sees not just our outward performance, but the recesses of our heart. We need something more impressive than gold medals and gold records. We need forgiveness. We need our sins wiped away, and of course that's what Jesus came to do. He came to bring forgiveness. The Father sent his Son to die for our sins, to take our identity of guilty sinner upon himself, to bear the shame and the consequences of that identity, so that the blot can be removed, right? So that our record can be cleansed. And we can go further here, right? Because we're not only forgiven by Jesus' death, but we're accepted as well. It's not that God forgives us and says, okay, now you're forgiven. Go ahead. Go. Right? You know, no, he accepts us. Jesus, we're told, is rejected by the Father at the cross, right? That's the cry of, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus is rejected. He is forsaken, rejected by the Father, so that we might be accepted. Right? He took our sin that we might have his righteousness. He took our rejection that we might have his acceptance. And yet there's more, right? The Bible says we're not only loved, we're not only forgiven, we're not only accepted in Jesus, but we're also justified. Now, justification is a technical term in the Bible. It means to be declared righteous. And the Bible teaches that when we believe in Jesus, our identity as sinners is given to him, and his identity as the righteous son is given to us. And you remember Harold Abrahams, the runner, said that he had 10 seconds to justify his existence. Now, that's a slightly different use of the word justify, but it's actually not as different as you might think. And he was saying that he wanted to show that his life meant something, that it was worth it, that he had a place in the world. And go back to Genesis, right? Go back to that original approbation where God looked at humanity and said, it is very good, meaning that this world, these people, they are just what I meant them to be. They fit in my world. They have a place in my world. They are good. They are right. Their life means something. Well, Jesus came into the world, and he did just what the Father told him to do. He always pleased the Father. The Father says of Jesus at one point, actually at multiple points, this is my beloved Son. With him I am well pleased. Jesus always did what pleases the Father, and so he fits, right? He has a place in God's world, the place that God had designed for him. He was living that out. That's what it means to be righteous. It means to live in the place that God has designed for you. When we come to Jesus, we are justified. We are declared righteous, meaning we have a place in the world. We fit like a round peg in a round hole. God sees us as fitting in his world. So when we come to Jesus, God says, I love you, I forgive you, I accept you, you fit in my world, you have a place. And yet it doesn't end there even, because Jesus teaches that for those who belong to him, those who follow him, that one day we will hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. One day we will hear the Father's approbation, his applause, and that actually is what we should be living for. C.S. Lewis, in another essay, The Weight of Glory, he interacts with this idea that we should be living to hear the praise of God. And he at first finds the idea wicked and arrogant. But then eventually he sees that actually it's incredibly humble. And he says this, and it's a longer quote, but it's worth reading. He says, I suddenly remembered that no one can enter heaven except as a child, and nothing is so obvious in a child, not in a conceited child, but in a good child, as its great and undisguised pleasure in being praised. Not only in a child either, but even in a dog or a horse, he says. This is, in fact, the humblest, the most childlike, the most creaturely of pleasures. Nay, the specific pleasure of the inferior. The pleasure of a beast before men, a child before its father, a pupil before its teacher, a creature before its creator. I am not forgetting, he says, how horrible this most innocent desire is parodied in our human ambitions, or how very quickly, in my own experience, the lawful pleasure of praise from those whom it was my duty to please turns into the deadly poison of self-admiration. But I thought I could detect a very, very short moment before this happened, during which the satisfaction of having pleased those whom I rightly loved and rightly feared was pure. And that is enough to raise our thoughts, he says, to what may happen when the redeemed soul, beyond all hope and nearly beyond belief, learns at last that she has pleased him whom she was created to please. He goes on a little bit later. He says, the promise of glory is the promise, almost incredible and only possible by the work of Christ, that some of us, that any of us who really chooses, should actually survive the examination, shall find approval, shall please God. To please God, to be a real ingredient in the divine happiness, to be loved by God, not merely pitied, but delighted in, as an artist delights in his work or a father in a son, Lewis says, it seems impossible, a weight or burden of glory which our thoughts can hardly sustain, but so it is. See, the identity that we all have is this. We're all created in, we're all creatures created in the image of the divine with this beautiful potential and yet created to receive the applause of God. But we're also creatures who have been broken by sin with the devastating consequence of God's rejection. And yet there remains this amazing love of God for sinners, right? Love that sent his son to the cross to take on our identity that we might have his identity. And when we look to Jesus and believe, we find that we are loved, we are forgiven, we are accepted, we are justified, we are delighted in by the one person that matters most. And do you see how freeing that can be? If I am loved, if I am accepted, if I'm delighted in by God, I don't need to chase after those things from other people, which means I'm finally free to actually love other people rather than to use them to build up my own ego. And think about it. Could you imagine coming to campus for the first time or going anywhere, moving to a new place for the first time, and rather than being terrified, wondering who is going to like you, who will reject you, who will approve of you, thinking, who can I love? Who can I bless? Who can I serve? And not just to make myself look good either, but because I genuinely just want to love people. That's what the work of Jesus is actually meant to do. It's meant to give us an identity grounded in our relationship to God, grounded not in what you do for God, but grounded in his love for you shown in the cross. And that enables you to show the same kind of love to those around you. I think we're going to stop there. There are snacks in the back, so we don't have to leave. We can eat and have some soda. I was going to say eat and drink, but that has different connotations. We can eat and we can have soda. And if you have questions, we can talk. I know that was like a deluge. I feel like it was a lot to think about, maybe.